Hello, this is Earl Fontenelle. This is the Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast, and today we are delighted to be speaking with Yusuf Casewit, Associate Professor of Quranic Studies at the Divinity School at the University of Chicago, a man who knows a thing or two about the more esoteric reaches of Islam, especially vis-a-vis North African and Andalusian figures, spirituality, mysticism, all that good stuff. Yusuf, thank you so much for meeting up with me to talk about Ibn Barajan.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be on this podcast. It's been a great source of inspiration.
Top man. Ibn Barajan, as we were just discussing off mic, is one of these figures that is extremely interesting in his own right, theologically. He's extremely important in the transmission of esoteric ideas in Islam and is on almost no one's radar, right? He's one of these quasi-forgotten figures. So it's great to talk about him. Mm. And the best way to begin, I think, is to talk about his basic bio, his basic biography, what we can say about him for sure. I know that there's a lot of gaps in our knowledge, but, you know, when did he live? What did he get up to? What was going on at the time? And then once we've done that, we can dive into some metaphysics and theology and stuff like that.
Sure. Well, Ibn Barajan al-Ishbili, he's from Seville, but he's buried in Marrakesh. He dies in 1141, and he's the grandson of immigrants from Tunisia, from Ifriqiya, who had settled there sometime during the Taifa period. So the Al-Andalus broke down into small sort of petty fiefdoms.
Yeah.
After the fall of the Umayyad dynasty, which reigned supreme for almost 250 years, and when it collapsed, the political vacuum that was left behind was filled by these smaller city-states, and Ibn Barajan's family settled there, you know, sometime in the 11th century, and he grows up in the shadow of the Almoravids, which is the dynasty that took over, held sway over Al-Andalus for over 100 years and was able to keep the Reconquista somewhat at bay. Mm-hmm. And they ruled from Marrakesh. So he finds himself sort of at the tail end of this Almoravid, Almohad transitional period. He spent most of his time on the Iberian Peninsula in Al-Andalus. During his day, most scholars actually were unable to perform the Hajj, and so he had to really educate himself and teach in a context where all his resources were confined to Seville and its environs. And we know that he likely traveled to Cordoba and some other cities in Al-Andalus. But what you have in the case of Ibn Barajan is really a purely Andalusian figure in that regard, because he never received much of an educational formation, let's say in Baghdad or in Cairo, unlike scholars before him and after him who performed the pilgrimage. During his day, the pilgrimage routes were blocked by pirates and crusaders, and there was the Reconquista. And so my interest in this figure really was piqued when I came across references to him in the writings of Ibn Arabi, the famous Mursian mystic, Sufi, author of the Meccan Openings, and a very influential figure in the history of Islamic thought. And when I started exploring his extant writings, all we had really was one or two articles from the early 1900s by Ignaz Goldsier, the remarkable Orientalist, who had a thing or two to say about Ibn Barajan's sort of political, epistemological outlook. And that was it. And most of his writings were still in manuscript. That's how I initially began looking at him, and I realized that our understanding of Andalusian and North African intellectual history is largely confined to sort of the 13th century, you know, written output of the of Ibn Arabi on the one hand, and then the early 10th century writings of this mystic philosopher Ibn Masarra, who dies in 931, on the other. And so there was this sort of lacuna of 200 some years, and Ibn Barajan stands as the most prominent figure who helps us understand how we get to this point where Al-Andalus produces someone like Ibn Arabi.
Right, right, who's like a consummate, you could say, esoteric thinker, a consummate thinker across all the Islamic sciences, but also incorporating all that which we call mysticism, all that which we call spirituality, a lot of what we might call alphanumeric metaphysics, you know, the works. He's the full package.
Right. He's a great visionary.
Yeah, visions, of course.
He's a great synthesizer of previous traditions, strands of Islamic thought before him, theological, spiritual, philosophical, Sufi. He has, we're talking about Ibn Arabi.
Yeah.
He has, you know, this sort of monumental outpouring of writings that really mark this almost like what you could call an ontological turn in understanding the relationship between God and the human being and the world. And so perhaps one of his most important contributions is to shift away from a purely sort of Aristotelianized Neoplatonism or an Asharite voluntarism to this sort of syncretic Quranic worldview that looks at the relationship between God and the world not in terms of divine will or in terms of purely sort of let's say an Aristotelian cosmology, but rather in terms of gradations of being as understood through a Quranic language, which in the Quran, being and mercy are synonymous for Ibn Arabi. And so when you read him, he recasts a lot of terms that you're familiar with the Quran, in the Quranic tradition, into an entirely sort of fresh perspective. And a lot of the sort of the powerful insights that he that he articulated, to my mind, are because he's an Andalusian who's drawing upon previous traditions like Ibn Barajan, Ibn Masarra, and so on before him, who themselves were reading quite broadly, and he's bringing it all to bear sort of in this new what's called an Akbarian framework, or a framework of Ibn Arabi's Sufi metaphysics.
Akbarian because he is known as a Sheikh al-Akbar, like the greatest Sheikh,
right,
the greatest spiritual master, so hence Akbarian. Very briefly, to touch back on politics before we move on, because I'm not a specialist here and I know a lot of our listeners aren't. We have the Umayyads in the far west of the Islamic world. Now, we thought that the Umayyads sort of collapsed when the Abbasids took over, but no. This is like the rump state of the... So the first pan-Islamic empire, which was the Umayyad state, right? Well, the first one that you can recognize and say, that's definitely a state anyway. It had indeed been taken over by the Abbasids, but in the west, a branch of the Umayyad family had hung on to power for a long time. So that explains what they're doing there, right?
Right.
And we also have the Fatimid ingredient in the pie now.
Right.
Right? So the Islamic world is more fragmented politically than it has been earlier.
Yes, you have three contending caliphates, in a sense.
Yeah.
So when the Abbasids are overthrown, briefly, you have the Prophet dies in 632, and then you have four caliphs, right? The period of the rightly guided caliphs, as it's called, and you have then the rise of the Umayyads in Damascus, and they're overthrown in 750 by the Abbasids. One Umayyad prince survives this Abbasid revolution through and goes on this epic journey, ends up in North Africa, where he had, I believe through his mother, he had relatives there, and then ends up in Al-Andalus, where he's able to unite the local tribes and establish himself as the only person who could really bring together and claim sort of political legitimacy. And by it's the early 900s, so by the caliphate of Abd al-Rahman III, you have the Umayyad political leader proclaiming himself to be Khalifa, to be a caliph. Mm. And it's you have Fatimid at the time, sort of in North Africa, in the region of Tunisia, and then in Cairo. And it's a Shiite dynasty, sort of Ismaili-inspired Shiite dynasty that claims the status of caliph alongside the Abbasid caliphate. Mm. So really what you had under the Abbasids, you could think of it as you had a local military dictator, and then you had the Khalifa who symbolizes the religious and political legitimacy of the state, and you had scholars who were mediating between the leader and the local military dictator, quote unquote, in charge, mm. and the general populace. So you had three contending caliphs. And when the Umayyads of Spain, when they collapse, it gives rise to an imamate crisis.
Right.
A crisis of who's in charge, who has legitimacy, and very few could really, among these small kingdoms in Al-Andalus, could claim legitimacy. Some drum up a phony caliph.
Right.
Others claim that lineage, back to the Prophet or Arab lineage is what gives one legitimacy. Prominent families stepped in to fill the political vacuum. And finally, after half a century or so, these desert monarchs of the Almoravids, they seize control of Al-Andalus. They're actually initially invited by scholars across the straits to really, it was a foreign aid intervention, medieval style. And he and Yusuf ibn Tashfin is able to assemble troops and implant himself in Al-Andalus after two major military expeditions.
Yeah.
And that's how you get the beginning of the Almoravids, where Ibn Barajan finds himself.
Yeah. This is all politics that it's worth coming back to again and again for the purposes of the podcast, because all of the question of, not to dwell on it too long, I want to get back to Ibn Barajan, but the question of imama, who is the rightful imam stroke khalif, has major religious overtones to it, especially I would say vis-a-vis the Fatimids, because they're presenting themselves as the true representatives of the family of Ali, as the Islamic as bearers of an Islamic esoteric wisdom that goes back to the Prophet himself and has been transmitted through the imams. So they're sort of messianic and esoteric overtones to their entire political project. And the same is true in a different way of the Abbasids, at least in their propaganda. You know, they present themselves very much as a kind of divinely sanctioned overthrow of something that was not quite as divinely sanctioned, Mm-hmm. So all this political stuff is really interesting. But let us talk about our guy, Ibn Barajan. We don't know that much about his day-to-day life, do we? Like, did he have kids? Was he married? How did he studied, but where and how? Do we know any details of that stuff?
He studied mainly in Seville. He had a stellar Andalusian religious formation. He mastered the literary linguistic sciences of his day, what we call ulum al-ala, the instrumental sciences, grammar, logic, morphology, and rhetoric. And he had an inclination, sort of an expertise in hadith, in the mm-hmm. science of transmitting prophetic sayings and assessing their authenticity. And he taught in the Grand Mosque of Seville for quite a while, which is now the Grand Cathedral of Seville. Mm. He had a family. He withdrew to sort of the outskirts of Seville sometime in his 40s. My guess is that he had some kind of agricultural source of livelihood, maybe in the olive business. He did not take a state pension. He sort of kept the political realm at arm's length, but he was very much aware of the political atmosphere he found himself in, and he was regarded probably as a by his 40s as a senior hadith scholar with whom you study after you've done your foundational training. You go to him for the the mystical, the spiritual connections to that formal training. So he's sort of he would take probably, relatively smaller numbers of students who might have been more esoterically inclined, who thought in terms of correspondences between above and below and so on, but very much within a Quranic and Hadith tradition. But, you were mentioning the question of politics, and it's important to note that here's a scholar who's risen to prominence, who's regarded very highly by the other major like-minded Sufi scholars of his day, like Ibn Qasi or Ibn al-Arif, and he's seen as sort of the senior figure, and he's held as a result with suspicion by the powers that be, who were weary of any charismatic, high-profile, syncretic thinker who's not directly tied to the state, and that the state itself was very much in the hands of the qadis, of the judges.
Right.
And so when Ibn Barajan articulates his epistemologies and his sort of esoteric doctrines, he has to do that, of course, within his context, and that's why he recasts. He's sometimes discreet about his sources. Mm. He's aware of the charged, politicized nature of his teachings.
Right.
So in his day, Ghazali's writings, the Ghazali, this great 12th century Persian polymath who writes in Arabic and Persian, and is probably one of the greatest legal thinkers and sort of integrators of the various Islamic sciences in his revival of the religious sciences, Ihya Ulumuddin. His works literally catch fire in Al-Andalus, and they become sort of a rallying point. They're burnt and so on. And Sufism at that point becomes tied to an anti-Almoravid sentiment.
Right.
And when he's arrested, when Ibn Barajan is arrested in toward the end of his life and brought to Marrakesh, the leaders, the rulers, the emir in Marrakesh was suspicious of Ibn Barajan as being some kind of politically ambitious figure, which to my mind he wasn't.
Yeah.
I can't really find proof of him being politically ambitious. There's one report that the prayer, the sermon on Fridays was made in his name in villages, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
Right. Which to, for context, the what you'd normally expect is that the legitimate Khalifa would be the one who's mentioned by name.
Yeah.
And you know, prayer, and Allah is asked to bless that guy. So if you're mentioning someone else's name, that could imply that they see themselves as somehow equal to or more important than or an alternative ruler to.
It's a direct affront of the dynasty.
Yeah,
to this very day in Morocco, if you go to pray the Friday prayers, there's a prayer for the ruler, for the king. Yeah,
yeah.
And that's just sort of how it has to be. If one made a prayer for some in someone else's name, that would be politically very dangerous.
The police would show up next Friday and see what's what.
That's right. So Ibn Barajan, I feel, gets caught and perceived as a political threat for good reason, because, someone of a very similar profile called Ibn Tumart, only a few years after Ibn Barajan's death, actually causes a revolution and overthrows the Almoravids. And so, in a sense, the Almoravids had their finger on the pulse. When Ibn Barajan dies, as I said, he wasn't politically active, but when he dies, the entire city of Marrakesh sort of revolts against the caliph's command not to attend his funeral prayers, and they all come out and pray for him, and he's buried in the city of Marrakesh. And only a few years later, you had the Ibn Qasi, who's a sort of a similar-minded revolutionary in Al-Andalus, and you have Ibn Tumart, who comes from the east with Ghazali's writings and starts sort of using Sufism partly as a rallying point and a call for the establishment of a new political dynasty.
Mm.
So Ibn Barajan was, in a sense, forced to articulate his esoteric teachings and letterism and so on in the sort of within this atmosphere, and that very much shapes his writings. When I first started reading him, I was expecting a much more explicitly esoteric figure.
Right.
And it's the subtle cues and the threads of thinking and sort of clusters of ideas that excite him. That's where you start finding some of the, you know, what I would consider the gems and the good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Let's talk about his works. He has four works that we know of, right? All of which survive in manuscript, or some have now been edited.
Right. So he has two Quran commentaries, a major one and a minor one.
Yeah.
And he has a commentary on the divine names. These three survive. The major commentary is five volumes long, Tanbihul Afham. It's the alerting of intellects to contemplate the signs of God in creation. And then Idahul Hikmah is a text that I edited with my advisor, Gerhard Bovring, when I was in graduate school. It's called Idahul Hikmah bi Ahkam al Ibra. That is to say, elucidating or deciphering wisdom through the properties of this crossover into the unseen. It's sort of a text. Yeah, the Ibra, the act of contemplating and existentially connecting with and crossing over into, like, from the visible to the unseen. So that's his second work. It's the minor tafsir or Quran commentary. Then he has a Divine Names commentary. It's two volumes, and he examines many of the cosmological disclosures of these divine names, and he offers some ethical advice on how to conduct oneself in light of the divine names. And then there's a lost work. It's a work where he looks at the hadith tradition, the tradition of sayings of the prophet, and he shows how they cohere with the Quran.
Right, and like a concordance. Yeah, it's a Quran and hadith concordance.
Yes, and it speaks to his tendency to bring disciplines together and to think holistically and to see correspondences. So he'll take a prophetic report and he'll find its root in the Quran. So for him, the Quran is the root of prophetic teachings, and the prophet is the embodiment of the particular within sort of the universal framework of the Quran. It's the day-to-day. And so every saying and tacit approval and action that the Prophet makes for Imbarajan can be rooted or traced back to the Quran itself. Mm-hmm. And this is important for him later, because when he explores other bodies of writings, esoteric works and so on, because he reads broadly, he'll use this principle of Quranic, what I called something like Quranic hegemony, where he's, the Quran becomes the yardstick by which you measure truth, and it's like from a place of you could say exclusive commitment to the Quran, he broadens out into a vast sort of universe, and he's able to incorporate it. So he absorbs biblical passages very freely into his works, and he's able to engage with works that sometimes polemical thinkers don't even want you to touch. Right,
like what?
Well, the philosophical writings of the Brethren of Purity, for instance, the Ikhwan al-Safa, they're perceived often, and you know, by the scholarly class of his day, as being unworthy of being read, because you have prophetic guidance that's clear and unmixed, and then you have these philosophically sort of tainted writings of the Brethren of Purity. So for Ibn Barajan, you know, that he dives deep into the, you know, into the deep end of the pool, but he has a rope. He's, you know, which is the Quran, and in this book where he shows correspondences between hadith and Quran, it's foreshadowing his later explorations of other works, where he's plunging deep into other traditions, but always connecting them back to his secure Hablul Mateen, is the secure rope of the Quran. Mm. And so where you have topics that the Quran touches on extensively, he's not very interested in reading outside of it.
Right. Like, yeah, that makes sense.
Story of Joseph is articulated very clearly. 6 days of creation, we have quite a bit of material there. But then you have gaps in the Quran that are not touched, and then he'll dive deep into them, and he'll say, unless something contradicts, you know, this statement, and his epistemology is you know, capacious enough to encompass other traditions because of the Quranic anchor. So that's why I don't see it as just like another hadith concordance. I see it as like the seeds of his ambitious spiritual and intellectual sort of pursuits later on.
Let's get into his ambitious spiritual and intellectual pursuits later on. Let us unveil that which is veiled. If you can if such a thing is possible, can you give a summary of his metaphysical worldview? What's interesting about it? How do the names play into it? How does sort of proto-letterist understanding of Quranic language play into it, if that's a good way of putting it?
Sure. So if you open Ibn Barajan's works, you'll come across someone who's kind of writing from a stream of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It's you're dipping into a river and it just takes you wherever he wants to go. And so his Quranic commentaries are, this is not a verse by verse commentary on the Quran.
Right.
He'll take a cluster of verses and he'll expound upon them. And I suspect that the Quran commentaries themselves are actually transcriptions of his
flowing live, and one of his students is writing it down.
Yeah. And so he'll focus on certain themes that excite him. And that's how I started to get a sense of the themes that he's prioritizing and that he finds interesting. And so when I present his teachings, I'm trying to structure and organize what's really a flow of consciousness, and one should bear that in mind. One theme that emerges prominently is the universal servant, al-Abdul Kulli. And this is a term that he evokes throughout his works, and that seems to be an important, I guess you could say, concept. It's not really a concept, because a concept is delimited and it's confined. Al-Abdul Kulli is this reality through which God creates the world. And it stands as this principle between the relative and the absolute, and it sort of has a foot in both the uncreated and the created. And it foreshadows the well-known Sufi doctrine of the Insanul Kamil,
yep,
the perfect human being. You find references to the universal servant in the writings of the Ikhwanu Safa, the Brethren of Purity, these 10th century philosophers who were the first sort of Muslim thinkers to encounter and sort of to work through the Greek philosophical tradition within a Quranic worldview. So Ibn Barajan borrows from the Brethren of Purity when he articulates his doctrine of the Abdul Kulli, the universal servant, and it's the principle, you could say, that contains all the possibilities of the realm of creation. And it's through or because of the Abdul Kulli that you have this sort of this thinking of correspondences between the human being, creation, and revelation. So he describes it as the ark of Noah upon the ocean of all possibilities. So the Abdul Kulli, Noah's ark, contains all pairs of animals that will survive the flood.
Right.
And so you have the flood of the effusion of pure being that's then sort of contained, you could, like, the possibilities post flood, post creation, are contained within it. And so God says be, and the universal servant is prefigured in that very saying be, because God has knowledge of creation before he says be to it. And so Ibn Barajan is not articulating these immutable entities that Ibn Arabi talks about, where the reality of things in this world is God's knowledge of them before he says be to them. And you have these immutable entities in divine knowledge and so on that don't have any existence outside of the realm of divine knowledge. You don't quite get to that level with Ibn Barajan. You have this loosely articulated reflection on how the one connects to the many.
Yeah.
With a very Quranic sort of language.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a result, you have the correspondences between revelation, creation, and the human being. Another interesting idea. Should I keep going?
Well, that is an interesting idea. Let me ask you, if one wanted to go all philosophical, are we talking about something like the nous in Plotinus, like a Platonic world of forms, essentially? So if we have an as laid out in Plato's Timaeus, for example, you have a creator god who wills everything to happen. But he doesn't just will it and then it is. It's not creator and created. There's a mediating entity which has the creation, the particulars, latent within itself, not as particulars, but as essences. Is that something like what the universal servant is?
I think it comes close to it. Sort of a demiurgic figure, a logos in a sense,
yeah.
The nous. I mean, the late antique world, I mean, this was one of the most important, philosophical conundrums. And Ibn Barajan's response, you could say, or contribution to that broader conversation is this Abd al-Kulli. And I would say, yes, it resonates with a lot of these, the doctrine of the logos, or the nous, or the demiurge, except that he's more comfortable articulating it within the framework of the Quran, and so he'll evoke a verse, for instance, وَخَلَقَ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ فَقَدَّرَهُ تَقْدِيرًا. So God creates everything, and then He measures it out. Ibn Barajan would say, God creates the all thing. كُلَّ شَيْءٍ becomes he reads it. It's sort of a double literalism, where everything becomes the all thing with a capital
right.
A, and then he measures it out or expounds on it and differentiates it into particulars.
Yeah.
And so he'll return to that theme often. To approach an understanding of God, he says one should begin by trying to appreciate the mystery of the universal servant. And you do that through these verses of God creates the all thing, and then he differentiates it. So you like if you can in your meditation sort of step out of yourself and out of the world and like behold it all in one glance, what would it be? Post-divinist, after not pure divine, but what is that? Where you find yourself? It would be this liminal threshold between the uncreated and the created, which he calls the Abd al-Kulli. It's very hard to quote unquote conceptualize it, and so you do that through. Other small, hence his interest in signs of God and creation.
Right.
And he has this well-known concept of the reality through which creation is created, الحق المخلوق بالخلق, which is like a window onto the universal servant.
Right.
And I'd be happy to speak about that.
Well,
to follow up.
Maybe a thing to talk about is then the crossing over. If this is the time to talk about that, because you're talking about how a human being might come to apprehend or have a more direct knowledge or an experience of this universal servant, this mediating manifestation of Allah. It would be traditional in history of philosophy to describe it as an emanation, although that's kind of a misleading metaphor, because no emanatory metaphysics is actually posits emanation exactly, So how does one do this? Now, in later Sufism, the Sufism of the orders, we're going to have, depending on the order, we're going to have these sort of very set spiritual practices. Do this, then do this meditation, do these recitations, do dhikr, and this sort of thing. And that is going to awaken your heart. Your heart is the organ by which these higher realities can be apprehended, right? But it seems like for Ibn Barajan and for, I guess, some of his contemporaries, his cohort, while there is this kind of renunciant tradition going on, there's a sort of scholar ascetic way of life that he and his guys represent. Not exactly monastic, but definitely renunciant. But aside from that, what is the practice? What is the crossing over? How does one do it? You contemplate the signs of God in reality. So you're looking for traces of the divine in the particular, right? Interpenetrating everything. Then what? Is that it? Is it simply an attention, like a focused attention on viewing the world and seeing God's traces within it?
Right. So during the 12th century, Sufism was more free and flexible,
yeah.
You could say, less institutionalized. You don't have initiations and codified litanies that I can really put my finger on as being passed down from generation to generation and sources of teachings and so on. Although it's beginning,
right,
it's starting, and it becomes very evident by the 1200s. Ibn Barajan is operating in the early 1100s. So you have people moving from spiritual teacher to spiritual teacher, and there's a sense of camaraderie between them. So there is a sense of collective sort of belonging to this more, spiritually inclined or esoterically inclined regional community.
You see this in Ibn Adabi really clearly, because he travels all over the Islamic world and he's looking for the local friends. Every time he shows up in a town, he's looking for like the spiritual heads,
right,
and then he meets them and they sometimes just look at each other in silence and then he says, his spiritual state was such and such.
Exactly.
And then he moves on, you know.
Yeah, they assess each other.
Yeah.
And I mean, it makes sense. Like-minded people tend to rub shoulders in every generation. I mean, who would have known that I would be sitting with you, Earl?
Indeed. Indeed.
It's because we have certain ideals that we share. That we're part of some kind of broader sort of episteme of some sort, and it just makes sense that at some point we'd sit down. And so Ibn Barajan likewise met every person that I would consider to be interesting in his day on the peninsula, or had some kind of correspondence with them. So they're rubbing shoulders, they're meeting, they're exchanging ideas. They're aware of the existence of formal khanaqas in the East, formal Sufi lodges where one can withdraw from the world and, let's say, put in 6 months to just focus on the inner life and go under the, subject oneself to the training of some spiritual teacher or belong to a community. There are, within the cities, there are well-known scholarly or charismatic Sufis or merchants or have everyday jobs that and people gather around them, and they have sessions of, they'll read devotional poetry or they'll have remembrances and so on. So it's, when I say that Sufism was not institutionalized, I don't mean to say that that there aren't groups, that there aren't communities forming. There are communities that are forming. It's very clear from the lives of these figures. Ibn Barajan's practice within this context he describes it once in a while, focusing on turning down the noise a bit, and he recommended moving out into nature. He found the light pollution of 12th century Seville to be a little too much for him,
right, yeah.
And so he moved out into the backlands of the city of Seville, and recommended for his students, if they want to really practice i'tibar and to really become connoisseurs of God's signs in creation, the first step is to the extent possible, step away from day-to-day sort of workaday life and calm the mind and calm the daily rhythm, slow things down. And then, as I have a quote here just to quote him. He says, "The heart is alive and the pen is dead. And the shortest path to unveiling that I know of is to train the soul by cultivating stillness of its inner movements, then stillness of the outer body, and if possible, to reside in a place where you can behold natural phenomena from near and afar, for that is the most helpful in your quest. But if you cannot live in solitude, then behold it by casting your sight upon the sky, earth, winds, plants, animals, and other existence, and on that basis, consider their analogues in the unseen." So you have an emphasis on stillness of the inner sort of world of thoughts and of the body. You have an emphasis on becoming conversant in the signs of God. And he, of course, practices dhikr, or remembrance, repetition of certain divine names. And his method was to invoke the name Allah repeatedly, and if or when the mind becomes distracted, to gently pull it back to the center by evoking other names. So you say Allah repeatedly, And then if my mind starts thinking about some deadline, I can say Allah Kareem, Allahul Kareem, Allahul Kareem, God the Noble or something. And then suddenly I've sort of hooked, you know, my attention, I've tethered it to a quality of God, a name, and then that brings me back. Mm. So I think, so aside from this sort of practice of really withdrawing and invoking, reading broadly, and spending time with people who are ambitious in their sort of pursuit of virtue and of the spiritual life, the practice of i'tibar, to my understanding, is sort of this methodical practice of looking at or beholding a sign of God as a passageway to a divine quality. Mm. So the Quran is replete with signs, right? Behold the sun and the moon and so on. These are everyday signs that we see every day. And the Quran seeks to awaken our wonder in the signs of God and creation. Sort of like, wake up, look at the sun, look at the moon, look at the sky. The Quran begins with the broad, the big, you know, verily in the creation of the heavens and the earth. It's always the non-differentiated and the differentiated. It's always the vast and then the narrower, right?
Right.
Inna fi khalqi samawati wal ard, right? The heavens and the earth, not the earth and the heavens. So begin with this vast. I mean, it's not quite the Abdul Kulli, the universal servant, but it prefigures it, right? This sort of broad unbinding. And then from there, you begin to sort of dissolve the delimitations and knots of the soul. And you move into this, you undertake this crossing or the Ibra when beholding the heavens becomes an experience of contemplating the quality of divine creation. So the Quranic verses are inna fi khalqi, it's in the creation of the heavens and the earth. It's not in the heavens and the earth. It's in the quality or the attribute of the creator that there are signs, right? And that's very close to the Abdul Kulli or the universal servant. It's he creates all things, then he configures them, then he differentiates them. And so behold the sun or the sky, and don't just marvel at its beauty, let's say, but marvel at its the qualities of creative power that's behind them, for instance. And so it's like, I mean, the example I give in the book is, it's like becoming an art connoisseur, where you can get an art connoisseur and you say, you know, who painted this? And they'll say immediately they develop this educated intuition that, oh, given the strokes and the ways in which, you know, the techniques used in this tableau, this is clearly Van Gogh. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You go directly to the author through the painting. And so that connoisseurship that you develop if you're deeply specialized in some body of knowledge is what he was seeking, but is a connoisseurship of God through creation on the one hand, and then the same he applies to the human being and to the Quran, and then he thinks correspondingly between the three.
Word. Becoming a connoisseur. Yeah, indeed. What role do the names of Allah play in this cultivation of a certain perception?
Well, they're what we can understand of God.
Yeah.
They are relationships between the divine and the created. They are the only window through which we can begin to apprehend the mystery of ultimate reality. Mm. And so they are the goal, initially, of this i'tibar, this process of crossing over into the unseen. You begin with the traces of these names, heaven and earth, and you move from the traces to the qualities of those names, the creator, the living, the knowledgeable, the powerful, and so on, the all-knowing, the omniscient. And from there, you enter into the pure, unqualified, sheer being of the divine reality. So the divine names are the highest science, the ultimate conception, quote unquote, that we could have in its sort of defining, delimiting connotations of the term concept or definition or science. The divine names are the discipline of commentary. The Islamic tradition is one of the most prolific traditions when it comes to writing commentaries on divine names. You have I've counted over 150 extensive commentaries on these names, and it seems to be a genre of literature that attracted scholars at senior phases of their life, where they're working through some of these theological, philosophical, Sufi, spiritual, esoteric, quote-unquote, problems, bringing all the disciplines that they've studied to bear upon them. And they're working through them in the language of relationality of the divine names, and they're not constrained by the formal disciplinary boundaries, let's say, of formal philosophy or dialectical theology of kalam, or even of the Sufi discourse on states and stations. When you say divine name, if I say, hey, tell me what you know about the name, the ever-creating, suddenly you can really be expansive and draw upon poetry and so on. So it's a inherently very contemplative discipline that Ibn Barajan was drawn to.
Contemplative, but also sort of endlessly creative, because as you say, when you can bring in poetry, you could write an entire commentary on one divine name if you wanted to, right?
Yeah.
And you're never going to run out of things to say.
Exactly.
So it's kind of, on the one hand, focuses the thought, focuses maybe your contemplation, depending on which name you're working with and so on. But on the other hand, it opens up the doors of hermeneutics to the whole world every time. Hmm. Right, it's both expansive and focusing, which I suppose is also true of taking Ibn Barajan's worldview, the Quran itself, which has a finite content, but is the lens through which he views everything else, and thus becomes sort of infinite. Although it does have a sort of channeling effect on how he views everything, it nevertheless doesn't restrict it down to a narrow blinker view. It expands out to encompass all things,
right?
And their origin.
Yeah, the Quran is a universe unto itself, like the created realm. If everything in creation is mediated through the universal servant, and everything is a sign of God pointing back to Him, and everything is a starting point or a bridge for undertaking the ibra, the crossing over into the unseen. The same with the Quran. Every verse is deliberately placed, every letter is deliberately articulated, and although you have many readings or variant readings or recensions of the Quran, he was attracted to all of them because all these different possibilities are expansive opportunities to undertake the crossing over, the ibra, just as the realm of nature is also a realm where one can undertake the crossing over. So he looks at the Quran as a sort of in its perfection, as a reflection of the universe in its plenitude, and he's interested in how the Quran connects internally. He's interested in its structure. He's interested in how the letters come together. He's interested in the same way as he's interested in biology and anatomy, and how things connect,
right?
And how sun and moon correspond. Similarly, he's interested in the structure of the human body, and then how the three, what he calls the three worlds, correspond: the world of creation, the world of scripture, and then of course the world of the human being. And so the Quran, in a sense, is like a condensed synopsis of what's unpacked and differentiated in the cosmos.
Right, like the Universal Servant is a ontological condensed synopsis of what's unpacked in the
divine reality. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So he's thinking constantly in correspondences.
Yeah.
And he's sometimes, when you're reading him, you're not sure if he's talking about God or a sign of God or a trace of a sign of God, or it's not clear what level
bleed through is going on.
Yes.
Which is to me, to my mind anyway, the sign of a really serious mystical writer. And by that, I mean specifically someone who is trying to push at the edges of what language can do to make it achieve something that it can't quite do. Hence, I mean, Plotinus is the master of this. Hence, you find yourself unclear at what register you're speaking, or you start out at the register of, say, a Quranic verse. You might say you're almost in like literary studies field, and then suddenly maybe we're talking about ontology, and maybe we're talking about the processes by which the unity beyond unity of Allah becomes multiplicity, and then do you know what I mean? But you're not quite sure. And maybe we're talking about something going on in the heart of an individual human being as well, like something sort of phenomenological at the same time. This is the good stuff.
And he's comfortable, in a sense, with that ambiguity.
Yeah. You don't collapse it. You just leave it there in the text and kind of let it simmer.
Right. And he's, I mean, often you could say he's dissatisfied with really hard binaries and hard boundaries. He likes the raggedy edges of these sort of realities. So he tends to, for instance, blur the line that separates the here below and the hereafter, the visible and the unseen, and he'll show you how and why these boundaries can be crossed, even while maintaining the fact that there is a category of beyond the senses that is unseen. But he'll use the terms because they're convenient. You know, when we say this life and the next, you're thinking in terms of sequences. Right. You have this world and then the world to come. But he's also aware of the fact that the world to come is not necessarily a linear time-based reality that will come, you know, in X number of years. It's also something that's happening simultaneously in the very present moment.
Right.
And so he wants you to be aware of the fact that when we use words like this world and the next, we're using these sort of spatial metaphors or temporal sequential metaphors that he wants to shatter at a certain point.
Right. You can see why the sort of Ashari or standard Maliki ulama might have found that all a little bit too much, right?
Yes. He's accused of wanting to peer into the unseen, wanting to manipulate forces of nature to exert influence in the here below. He's accused of claiming access to realms of knowledge that are reserved just for God. But when you read him carefully, he's still working somewhat within the mainstream theological framework. He's just trying to disrupt it to a certain extent so as to allow for sort of breathing room. And he's trying to expand the epistemologies of his day. I mean, nominally, he's a self-proclaimed Asharite thinker, except that he has a distaste for zeal and excessive enthusiasm for one's own school of thought that then closes one's sort of horizon and so on. So when given the opportunity, he'll always show you where the lines are blurry, and sometimes he'll venture into, give you a concrete example of instances where one can peer into the unseen. And that's what happens with his famous prediction of the recapture of Jerusalem.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's bring things back to the very particular, and maybe that's a good thing to finish with, because it's a sort of karma, it's a sort of miracle, and it's a very peculiar thing that happened. We started with politics. This brings us sort of back into politics in a way. What's this prediction all about?
So after Ibn Barajan dies in 536 of the Islamic lunar calendar, the Hijra calendar,
1141 CE,
about 50 years after his death, Salahuddin Ayyubi, Saladin, recaptures the city of Jerusalem from the Crusaders in 583. And in his major Quran commentary, the Tanbih al-Afham, Ibn Barajan has a detailed discussion of the exact date when the Muslims would recapture Jerusalem, based on a reflection on, or you could say ibrah, an act of crossing over into the unseen, a reflection on the opening verses of the chapter 30, Surah Ar-Rum, chapter 30, Surah 30 of the Quran, the surah, the chapter on that begins with a discussion of the defeat of the Byzantines. Ghulibati Ar-Rum, the Byzantines and the Persians had been fighting and so on, and they're defeated, and the Quran predicts that after their defeat, they will be victorious fi bid'i sinin, in a few years. And so Ibn Barajan reflects on this verse of fi bid'i sinin, in a few years. And bid'a in Arabic is between 3 and 9. And he's interested really in signs of God at the largest scale. And so for him, it's cyclical nature of time. He calls these dawa'ir al-taqdir, the cycles of divine decree. And he sees the ebb and flow, the rise and fall of civilizations and dynasties and religions and so on as conforming to these meta cycles of divine decree. So really he's not interested in predicting the recapture of Jerusalem as much as he's interested in his reader appreciating the cyclical nature of the descent of the divine command. Because if you can understand how it descends and cuts across different levels of the cosmos until it reflects in the particulars, then you can ascend back to the divine reality.
Right.
And so he traces these 6 cycles. The number 6 appears very prominently in his thinking about the cycles of divine decree, and in thinking about when the Muslims would recapture Jerusalem. And he comes up, he's off by 2 days. Battles drag on for many days, so one could really say he's actually spot on. And I have a detailed discussion of the prediction and a translation of it, and it's not the only one he makes in his Quran commentary. He makes a few others with similar sort of epistemology and similar idea of the centrality of number 6 and the cycle of divine decrees. And I guess after the recapture of Jerusalem, Ibn Barajan becomes quite famous in the Islamic East, where they behold his Quran commentary, and it's read from the pulpit of the Masjid al-Aqsa, the mosque of al-Aqsa, on the first Friday prayer after the recapture of Jerusalem. And Salah ad-Din Ayyubi was, of course, an incredible general and heralded as celebrated as one who's dealing very justly with the ruthless crusaders and so on. But he develops this reputation at that point, and the entire Andalusian, Maghribi, North African, mystical, Sufi, occult, esoteric scene sort of gains a lot of street credibility,
right,
in the East because of this very famous prediction. And later authors, like Ibn Arabi, will look back to this passage and sort of comment on it, and they use the letterist back-projecting approach to arrive at the same date.
Right.
So they would break down the ba and the ayn and the dad and so on. But for Ibn Barajan, the calculation of the prediction was not letterist in the sense of breaking down letters and their numerical correspondences and so on, as much as it was 583 was a 6th cycle, so you have to understand the significance of number 6 in sort of the meta overarching framework within his cosmology to appreciate what he's doing. But it's a bewildering passage that scholars initially who worked on it were tempted to dismiss as a scribal forgery.
Added later, yeah.
It's the simplest, you know, take the weird stuff off the table to make sense of of the world around you, right? So it's, oh, this has to be a later scribal edition, when actually the hard work is to really make sense of how this passage fits into his broader thought patterns. And you can see that it's intrinsically built into it, and it's, you have sort of very similar passages and discussions of that prediction elsewhere. So that's in short, I mean, without going into the mechanics of his prediction, I mean, that's in short an illustration of this Ibra, of this crossing over, and his how cosmology informs his reading of the Quran, and how it informs his understanding of the rise and fall of political structures around him, and so on.
On that note, Yusuf Kesewitz, thank you for bringing us so elegantly into the thought world of this gentleman on the concrete level, on the spiritual level, and maybe with a few concrete case study examples like the prediction about Jerusalem, to get a picture of Ibn Barajan's life and work. And until we meet again, stay esoteric.
Thank you.